Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's Managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new live episode of the Cinephiles. Cinephiles Live, we do this every month here on the show. We did skip last month for a number of reasons, but we are back again this month and today to do a live show here on the channel to talk about the 50th anniversary of Jaws. I am John Rocha, one half of the Cinephiles, joined as always by my shipmate, boatmate, whatever you want to say there, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
Ahoy, matey. I'm very good. And can I just totally take control for a minute and tell you a story that I think is important that you would enjoy?
Right off the bat. Yeah, go ahead. Knock yourself out.
So we were texting last night and I told you I was taking my son to see Monty Python and the Holy Grail in a theater for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I had ever actually seen it in a movie theater. And I just want to report back that not only did it go great, but that he had that experience that I think we want everyone to have, which is he saw it with a great audience who was laughing and it made the movie better and he laughed at new things. And then the craziest thing, which is, you know, at the end of the movie, they have the black where the music plays forever is the audience because it goes on and on and there's nothing on the screen. And first the audience laughs and then they laugh in a different way. And then the audience started clapping to the music. And my son started clapping. We're all clapping. And it went on and on and on for like 5 minutes and went through all the different kinds of laughter where it's like, oh, it's still going. I can't believe it's still going. Is everyone going to really keep clapping? And we all kept clapping for like five straight minutes in the dark, listening to this music. I think it was like the first kind of group theatrical experience where there will never be anything exactly like that again. And it was so exciting to have my kid in the movie theater get to have that kind of experience because he lives in a world where he has little screens in front of him where he's by himself all the time. Right. And so it was just like everything we've been talking about, why people need to go back to theaters. I had that experience with my kid last night, and I just wanted to share it with you before we got going.
That's great. That's awesome. Everyone, you know, we all have that moment growing up where we have that experience, that communal experience in the theater, and it really can change us or make us want it more. So I'm glad he was able to, especially with an old movie like that. It's not usually an old movie that gets us in that place. So the fact that those are so prolific in Los Angeles, it's kind of a gift to be able to share those kinds of things with your son and have him react to it and be and have that kind of an active audience, which is really rare in most cities. It's a lot of fun to see. It's one of the things I do miss about LA. So that's great. That's awesome to hear. Yeah. But we are here to talk about Jaws, the 50th anniversary of Jaws. Monty Python, the Holy Grail is an episode that we've done. Maybe your son will listen to our episode and have some thoughts about it. But another episode we did years ago was Jaws. And this one we did with our special guest, Eric Rogers, who is a showrunner and animation and writer as well, known for things like Futurama and the most recent Angry Birds series on Amazon. And Prime Video, rather, he was our guest for this episode. But, you know, it's been such a long time since we did that episode. When this 50th anniversary came up, Steve, I pitched to you like us doing this as a live show when you were 100% down because there's so much to talk about with this movie. And especially you having such an intimate experience having worked on and edited a shark documentary. And you and I have had a number of conversations off camera, off mic, about how there's a love-hate relationship that a lot of people in the shark community have with Jaws. So it's an interesting time to talk about it now and to assess it on its, can you believe this, 50th anniversary having come out in 1975. So at this point on June 22nd of 2025. What are your feelings and thoughts about Jaws as you look back on its 50th anniversary?
First of all, it is without question for me one of the greatest movies of all time. And you know, I do not have the power to place things so easily into top 10 lists as you do. Yes. But I will say that I think Jaws is in my top five movies. I really, ever. I love it so much. I think it is so great. I think it is. And it's one of those movies, too, where the movie is amazing and fascinating. The stories behind the scene are as interesting as the movie itself. And the filmmaking, all of the lessons of filmmaking, the advancements, the choices they made, those are all as interesting, and they're only basically, you know, like four or five movies that I can think of. Obviously, Kane being one, Apocalypse Now, The Godfather. Those are ones where that's true, where the movie is as interesting as behind the scenes is as interesting as the filmmaking.
Right.
And this is why it puts, frankly, it puts me in a real quandary, because we've been for a few years now redoing our earliest movies, because those are when we did films, and we didn't really quite have the format. We didn't know what we were doing. They were about an hour long. But then there's this later group of films where we had kind of started to figure it out, and we did some of the greatest movies of all time and some of our greatest episodes. And it's like, well, we would do them very differently today, but they were great episodes like this one with Jaws that we did. And I just want to read what some of these episodes, what we did around the time we did Jaws.
Okay.
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, The French Connection, Armageddon, Pulp Fiction, The Graduate, Silence of the Lambs, All the President's Men, Jaws, Star Wars, A New Hope, Blade Runner, and Some Like It Hot. That was the run that we did right around Jaws. Right. I like all of those episodes.
Yeah.
They're all good episodes. But I also think they're all about 2 hour, one episode.
Yeah.
And these would all be two or three parters going 4 or 5 hours. And so I think we could do it better now, but I also go, does it make sense for us to be redoing great episodes of the past? That's the quandary I feel like we're in at this moment.
I agree, especially because there are so many movies that we haven't done. And so to go back and start looking at these, I think though what we've done in the past, though, is picking one from 10 years ago, or sorry, picking a film from near the beginning of our time together and kind of redoing it in the style that we have today. And so those have been fun to revisit. I know we keep talking about Amadeus, which is absolutely in the rotation, possibly for this year, to revisit and do
it's
that.
It's loaded on my computer and ready to go. I have all the materials. I'm ready.
Right. But Jaws is an interesting one because a lot of our listeners really love that episode that we did on Jaws and enjoyed our guest as well as our points of views. So it's an interesting quandary to be in, because a lot of those older episodes, although they were shorter and don't get the cinephiles treatment, they were also one of the main reasons that we were able to accrue such a strong fan base. Obviously, me coming in with some of the fan base I brought in, but also people discovering it or people sticking around. It was those episodes that helped people stick around. So I think if we are very careful about when and which films we choose to redo, I wonder if our fans would be okay with that, or would they, or our listeners rather, would they be clamoring for us to focus on more recent movies or movies we haven't even done yet? You know, I was watching Fistful of Dollars last night, and I'm like, we haven't even done the trilogy. And now I'm thinking to myself, I should have been pushing harder for that. We're 9 years into the show officially. We just crossed 9 years, I think a few days ago, of doing the show, and I haven't pushed to do those three. And I would love to do those three at some point. So there are still a wealth of movies that we haven't even scratched the surface of. So I think we'd have to see what our fans, so those of you listening or those of you watching right now, maybe you want to let us know, and maybe we'll bring it up at our board meeting, Steve, that we do every month, and see what they think about it as well. For those of you who are on the Patreon at the board level, to see if they think Jaws is, or any of those films that you mentioned in the run, is something we should open the door to redoing again, because I will never be unconvinced to revisit a film that we've done before, because I love the movies, you know, so I'm down to do it.
It's so funny, because it occurs to me as you were talking that we are facing a classic Hollywood conundrum, which is the question of when is it appropriate to do a remake or a reboot?
that's
what we're talking about here.
Yeah, right.
It's like, we're going like, well, okay, we did like, for instance, in the very early days, we did The Magnificent Seven, Touch of Evil, Young Frankenstein, Amadeus, as you mentioned. There is no question in my mind, I want to redo all of those.
Agreed.
And that, but because they were like, it's like when there was a movie and it was a good idea, but the movie didn't quite work, but the idea is amazing, you want to do the remake. And that, and I think that applies to those. It's like, we just could do it a million times better today. But then when you get into the realm of, no, the our episode of Blade Runner with Scott Mance is a cinephile's classic. It is in the record books as one of the great conversations, but it's also only 2 hours. And today Blade Runner would be 5 or 6 hours, you know, to really get into all the detail. And so it's like, well, should we remake that one or should we not? And as you said, as these, as the shows have become regularly, you know, it used to be we were consistently one part and occasionally two. And then we became sort of consistently two parts. And now we're almost entirely two parts and frequently three. Yeah. And so that means there are fewer and fewer movies we're going to get to every year because we spend so much time on each one. And this is the balance of trying to figure out what should we do, you know? Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. But let's get back on track here and talk about Jaws, the movie itself. So I was asking your thoughts, and I know you mentioned that you veered off into the episode situation, but what about the movie now for you as Steve Morris, other than it being in your top 10? What do you, like, when you hear the word Jaws, when you think about the film Jaws, what comes to mind beyond its place in your rankings? Like, what are the images? What are the scenes? What are the feelings? What are the thoughts that come to mind when it comes to Jaws?
To me, it is a absolute work of art that is disguised as a monster movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because I think for people who don't really know a lot about Jaws, about the movie, just like they kind of go, oh yeah, that's this, you know, it's the action horror thriller movie about this monster shark. Sure. I get it.
Right.
But what it actually is an unbelievable work of art. Yeah. Every single, because I was just, you know, it was so funny. You texted me because you were watching it and I had kind of gone, I don't know if I have time to watch it. I know Jaws really, really well. I can do this live show without watching it. But then I went, you know what? What the fuck? And I sat down and I got all the way up to that climactic sequence right before I had to jump on with you. And I'm literally just going every shot, every single shot. There's something interesting. Every moment, every piece of sound design. Obviously, the John Williams score is phenomenal. Amazing. Yeah. The performances, the details. And here's the big thought that hit me this time watching it was, I was like, Jaws is without question the bridge movie between 70s filmmaking and what became the 80s and the future of Hollywood. Jaws is the linchpin. It is the transitional moment. Nothing more clearly shows the style of filmmaking from the 70s and everything that had been developed there and how we're moving into the big blockbuster world of the 80s.
Yeah, that and Star Wars. I think those are the two films you can look at as like becoming the modern Hollywood. And you could even argue that there's something quaint about Jaws now because it's before CGI. It's all practical effects, which is, of course, one of the legendary things about the movie, and the shark not working and that being a happy accident on the film. But, of course, there was so much that went on behind the scenes in the making of the movie that was tied to the special effects, or the practical effects, rather, that they used in the film, and the delays. Like, it was supposed to be, I think, like a 50-day shoot, ended up being a 159-day shoot. So it was a lot that went behind this movie, and yet in the end it ended up becoming a massive box office success. I think it's almost $450 million box office on a $9 million budget in the 1970s. Let that sink in. And all that it did for Hollywood was amazing. And I think it's one of those touchstones. It's one of those touchstone movies, not only because of the shark stuff, right? Because, I mean, we don't have Shark Week without Jaws, the enduring quality of Jaws, right? But we also don't have so much interest in studying sharks and studying these creatures and what they're all about if it wasn't for Jaws. So you could argue it brought positive and negative things to the world of sharks, but also the same thing with movies, right? We don't have blockbuster. There's no way we have Marvel without Jaws and Star Wars. Really, Jaws first, then Star Wars. We don't have that. You could even possibly throw Rocky in. We don't have those things until these. So in the same decade where we're seeing these incredibly gritty, questioning the systems of our government, questioning our existence these incredible films in the 1970s that are gritty, hard-edged films, we also have the beginnings of what will become the blockbuster mania. So both good and bad, Jaws is connected to a lot of things that are both good and bad in the world of film and in the world of shark studies as well.
I think it crystallizes so many things. So on the one hand, just in terms of sharks, I directed two great white shark films, and we were in the shadow of Jaws the whole time. I mean, the reason that the second shark movie has a blonde mermaid in it, which, you know, if you could see it, you could check it out. We could post the link. I believe it is still available to watch on YouTube. But the reason is that Hoover, my partner, said, I want to create an image. You know, in Jaws, the most terrifying image is the blonde going into the water and getting killed by the shark. You know, Chrissy goes swimming. And he said, I want to create a beautiful image of a mermaid swimming with a great white shark and even riding the dorsal fin. Mm-hmm. And the goal was to be the antidote of that image, because the thing that Jaws does so remarkably and has transformed our relationship to sharks in a way that is mostly pretty bad is that it created a narrative. You know, when Hooper has that speech of like, you're looking at a perfect killing machine, an eating machine, it kills and swims and makes little sharks. And none of that is true. Like, you know, all of that stuff is not the reality of what sharks are. But that narrative has stuck in people's heads. And the movie is so scary. And the sense of the unknown, because that's the difference, is like, you know, we're way more under threat from snakes, from dogs, from bees, from hippos, from, you know, all sorts of animals. But the thing about the shark is you can't see the shark.
Yes.
The shark is under the water. And so the invisibility of the shark, and this is what this movie does in this magical way, is because the shark didn't work, Spielberg had to come up with all these ways, the barrel, the pier, all these ways to make the shark visible in your mind when it isn't visible on the screen. And in particular, it's John Williams' music. So you feel the presence of the shark because of that music. You understand when it's rising, the shark theme is getting higher, when it's going accelerating, it's getting faster, when it's going farther away. We have this sense of the shark, and that is manufactured in our brain. And the shark we manufacture in our brain is 1,000 times scarier than the actual shark that's living in the water. And that is what's totally changed our relationship to this animal.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Steve, we're back again this month to talk about True Diagnostic, and I know this is something that you actually took and did, so I'm really curious about your process and what is this all about with True Diagnostic, brother?
Well, it's actually really interesting, because what they do is based on a simple blood test, which really didn't even hurt. They can give you all sorts of information about your metabolic markers, toxins, mitochondrial functions, serum lipids, but it doesn't stop there, because the recommendations they give you aren't general. They're specific to the results that you got on your test, and they have recommendations for supplements, exercise, and diet. It actually is a fascinating process.
That's awesome, because, you know, nowadays we're all trying to find out what's going on with our bodies as we're getting older, and we want to be aware of stuff so we can plan for stuff in the future. So that is great, Steve. And if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use our code CINEPHILES to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use CINEFILES at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
So, John, we're now 3 months into your weight loss journey with Awaken 180, and I was wondering how things are going.
It's pretty amazing. I'm almost at 40 pounds of weight loss since I started. I'm just 2 or 3 pounds away from being at 40 pounds since I started. And let me tell you something. I find myself in just a state of utter shock of how simple this was once you got past the first two couple of weeks, and how I've taken to the food that they've recommended and the food that they sell through their company to get me into the spot. And I do still occasionally find myself craving things, but I've also opened up a whole new world to eating that makes sense for me, that helps me feel good. And my numbers have gone down on everything, my cholesterol, my blood pressures, my issues, all that stuff. It's just been amazing to see how much my body has changed naturally and connected to these changes for me in terms of food.
Well, that just to me is the sign of a great program. I mean, if you can start off, have the success that you've had, and still feel comfortable as your health is improving, that's a great thing. And the big thing I'm wondering about is, how can we get more people to sign up for Awaken 180.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been the thing for me now is I'm in a place of where I want to share this with other people. I know some people will be like, well, that sounds a little bit like you're being a bit culty. No, that's not it. It's more a matter of, I know a lot of us struggle with our weight. I know a lot of us think we can't get it done. I know a lot of us even think that we're too old to start or, you know, to set in your ways. And I can't encourage you enough to give Awaken 180 a shot. This isn't just about promoting the product. I've lived it. I've done it. And I'm telling you, if you're hesitant, if you're unsure, if you're like a little nervous about trying it, they've got the 7-day money back guarantee. These people are incredibly nice and they will help you get to your goal weight and not make you feel guilty, not make you feel pressured, and assist you in any way, shape, or form that you need in order to get there. So I know some of you are struggling with weight, some of you are struggling with health issues. I can't encourage you enough to do this because it will absolutely change your life and you'll be surprised in such great ways about how it changes your body and your perspective and your mental health approach to the world as well.
So if you want to start your own weight loss journey, you can set up a consultation with a coach today at awaken180weightloss.com. That's awaken180weightloss.com and tell them the Cinephile sent you.
But we still, you know, we see those documentaries. They show the ferocity of a great white. They show that famous one from like a few years ago.
Disagree. I will strongly disagree.
Well, I think they show, this is my opinion, so I'm going to say it. I think they show the ferocity of a great white in terms of its strength and its muscle and its size.
Absolutely. No, I agree with that.
And its ability to do things. So I was getting at. And so when it attacked that seal from a few years ago, when they showed that video in slow motion, there is a majesty and a terror to seeing that for me when I watch it. And because of this movie, as you were mentioning, I'm trying to underline your point. I saw this movie in 1979 on TV. My parents, I was able to sneak downstairs and watch the movie. One of the dumbest things I ever did, scared the living hell out of me. And I still rarely go in the water past 3 or 4 feet. If I even go to the ocean, I'm like Martin, where I will sit in the car on a ferry. I don't care. Like just how I'm built because of seeing this movie at such a young age. So when I see this stuff, although I'm older and I can appreciate and respect some of the bias towards sharks that this film has put out there, I also credit it for giving me an appreciation for what this creature can do and the actual beauty of the creature in a lot of ways, even though it scares the living shit out of me still to see it in motion and to see it doing what it does. Yeah.
So obviously we want to talk about the movie, but just to talk about sharks a little bit longer, the reason I had that strong reaction to the word ferocity is that we tend to put an intention on sharks, and it's not the power. I agree with you 100%. These are unbelievably powerful animals. That's totally true. But like, for instance, you'll see on social media, you'll see an image of a person. They're like on a windsurfing board or something, and the shadow of a huge shark comes up and swims under them, circles them once and swims away. And then the caption will be, "Person narrowly avoids shark attack." And it's like, no, there was no shark attack. If the shark had wanted to attack that person would be dead. Like if you've ever seen actually how fast a shark can swim, it's like 15, 20 times faster than we can swim. There, anytime a shark is in the water with a person, it's perfectly capable of attacking them. And it doesn't. The real lesson is actually, look at how this shark had no interest in attacking this person. And so it's the language that I sort of object to when people, in the way they talk about sharks. And this is something in this, and I'll go on this digression quickly, and then we can get back to talking about Quentin Hooper and all that other stuff. But so one of the sections we have in the movie is about actually trying to film sharks, which is you're out on a boat somewhere and you got a camera and you want to get footage of sharks. So what do? You put a bunch of blood and food in the water, which means that the only sharks that are coming by are the sharks that are hungry. If they're not hungry, they're not coming by because sharks, and this was a study that's in our doc, is that they did a thing where they put a sensor in the belly of a great white shark to see how often it ate. It would eat a big, you know, hit an elephant seal, feed a huge amount of food, and then it wouldn't eat for over a month. And so this idea that sharks are like constantly eating machines looking for more food is not true. But the shots, like let's say now you're filming your shark documentary and you put chum and bait in the water and you're waiting for sharks to come in, and one kind of swims far away from the boat, and then it swims a little bit closer and you shoot it, and then it comes up and it looks at the food but doesn't take the food. And this happens over and over and over again. And as the editor on these films, I have hours of footage of sharks not biting at anything. Then there's this one shot where the shark opens its mouth and takes that big bite. Which shot's going to be in your movie? that shot. Right. That's the shot you're waiting for. And the problem that we see when people think about sharks is all they see is a couple of shots of them eating. They don't see the 50 times they don't eat because right. it's not dramatic and we don't put it on camera. And so the perception we have is based entirely on that. And this is where I go, like, if you only saw humans at a barbecue event eating ribs with their hands, you would go, look at these ferocious monsters rending the meat with it. And that's all you saw of humans. So this is the thing. It's like all we see of sharks is them eating. That's all we look for. And so then that's all we know about them.
Well, I'll say this. I've seen a lot of ferocious human beings. So I would still call anything that I think is possible, that I think is available to do terrible things as ferocious, because it's only my point of view. It's not intent. I'm not attaching any intention to it. It's just
I know you're not. I know
the speed and power and the muscles of that thing are truly intimidating. Absolutely. I feel the same way when I see a lion. I feel the same way when I see a silverback gorilla. There are just, for me, because I have a thing about this, there are animals in nature that absolutely scare the shit out of me and keep me in a city, because I don't go out into nature. It's not, I have no interest in it. Going to safaris or zoos, I have zero interest, but I love to watch the documentaries because I envy all of those people who can monitor and watch them and see their natural habitats and see the way they function and whatever. So I think it's fascinating. And I think it's also fascinating when you look at the movie here, Steve, the fact that this even came together in the way that it did, it really is one of these happy accidents and one of these blessed films that was destined to be made. Certainly Spielberg had to overcome so many things, kind of like Coppola in Apocalypse Now, having to overcome so many things just to achieve his vision. He did a recent introduction to Jaws for the 50th anniversary that's up on Peacock now. The film's available on Peacock if you guys have it. And he talks about the fact that this was his second theatrical film, and having to overcome so many things was a great test for him to prove that he really wanted to be a filmmaker. This, all the stuff he confronted, all the stuff he had to go through just to make it happen. And not just on set, but also some sniping battles with him and Peter Benchley and Carl, and at times Carl Gottlieb and things of that nature, because Carl Gottlieb wrote the screenplay, Benchley wrote the book that it's based on. So there was a lot of things that were going on, people doubting him, whether he was the right choice. He wasn't even the first choice to direct the film. So in the end, and then you get the talent like Richard Dreyfuss, who probably isn't the easiest person at that time in the 1970s, really feeling himself coming out of Broadway. Robert Shaw, an older actor on the tail end of his prime, who would die just a few years later. And Roy Scheider, who had really started to make his bones in the 1970s with Seven Ups and French Connection. Oh, and Ellen Gray, who plays Roy Scheider's wife in the movie, was married to Sid Sheinberg, who was a very big deal in Hollywood at the time. So there's a lot of power players underneath this young 28-year-old kid, probably 27 when he started making it, in his second film, Steve, and this was the result that came out of it. Pretty amazing.
It is an unbelievable accomplishment. And the big thing to me is that people just don't understand about directing, because people think like directing is like, I see what the movie is supposed to be, and now I will create that. And that ain't what it is. What it is you are in charge of chaos. And all sorts of things are happening. And you're constantly learning, the shark not working being the biggest reason. Like, oh, the idea that I had, I can't do. And now I have to figure out something else. The script in this moment isn't working. I mean, the Indianapolis script was rewritten over and over and over again to make that speech. I think the final pass is Robert Shaw writing on it. And he's learning it right before they shoot it. Right. And it's like those things are just barely coming together at the last minute. And and one of the most difficult ones was when Spielberg got the gig, I know they said, great, come shoot it at the tank at Universal. You have a nice tank and that's where we'll shoot it. You put up the big blue wall so it looks like the sky, it'll be great. And he goes, no, we're shooting it on the real water, which means that they go, it's just the horizon. So you can see 20 miles of open sea. And Spielberg is like, there cannot be another boat. If there's another boat in the shot, then that ruins the whole thing, because they have to seem like they're alone. So you're getting everything set up. You got the boats lined up. You got the cameras lined up. The shark is working. And you say, action. They say, wait, there's a boat on the horizon. And now you have to wait for an hour and a half for that boat to sail the 20 miles across the horizon before your screen is clear. And then you could try to shoot again. I mean, it's just a nightmare. Absolute nightmare.
I think the way the film is constructed is amazing as well. As I was texting you today, as I was watching it, like, because I'm kind of in that place where we, and it's funny you brought that up here in our conversation right at the beginning of the show. Like, the idea of us doing it, I was already in my head, like just watching the movie with so many thoughts that I want to talk about on the show, so many ideas that if we were ever able to do the movie again, I would want to talk about, because there is so much in Spielberg's direction here that is absolutely exquisite. I mean, I have never agreed that there is a perfect film, because I don't believe in perfection in any piece of art, myself personally. And so, but this is probably the closest, maybe one of the closest films to perfection. And I was watching this time with like, oh, do you need that shot? That is the actor doing well? Are they establishing things? I had no complaints. And that's a rarity for me when I'm watching a movie, even the way the camera lingers in certain shots, like when they're dragging Michael out from the pond after the shark has attacked that guy and killed him, the camera lingers on the tracks that his heels left in the wet beach sand. And I think that's so brilliant to show that and show you what that feeling is like and processing that situation, seeing what was once there now slowly disappearing right in front of you. Like, there's just something really smart about how he does that. The rack focus, of course, the legendary rack focus, the way he uses close-ups, you know, in focus and then someone else slightly out of focus right behind. There's just really smart things that he's doing with the camera, really amazing, brilliant things. The casting is really good. All the character actors who have one line to many lines here. I mean, Kintner's mom, she only really has two or three scenes in the movie, one extended scene, obviously, on the beach. But that scene where she slaps him, everything, the fulcrum of the movie is that moment. And so for me, there's so much about his direction that I think is brilliant. And it's also really funny to watch this in 2025. And I tweeted this out because Mayor Vaughn has a lot of interesting points of, like, you could just see him as a villain. But then when you watch the movie now, having heard some of the rhetoric that goes on in our world and from politicians and whatever, there are so many things that you hear him say in terms of reasons for the things that he's doing that you've heard other politicians say in order to cover the fact that they really only care about money and not human beings. And it's a fascinating thing to watch in the movie. And even when he finally signs the thing, it's under duress for himself, you know? And so there's so much, and him intimidating the coroner to change his assessment of what killed the young woman. It's just interesting to watch the movie now and how topical it must have felt in 1975. And sadly, 50 years later, still feels topical in our world today with how some of the actions of the characters in this movie happen, you know?
So many things to say. So yeah, the first one,
I go off sometimes. I apologize.
There's sometimes where it's like, I should take notes so I can remember things to get back to. But I want to go back to that shot of Michael, because I noticed it too when I was watching today. And I think, I really think that shot is PhD level masterclass filmmaking shit. Yeah. And this is why. Yeah. Because, so what happens, the way this moment happens, it's just been the attack in the pond.
Yes.
There's just the guy who was coming to help. And what we saw of him, he gets hit by the shark in some of what I think are actually the best underwater shots of the mechanical. It's really, really work. And then you see this guy's severed leg, bloody severed leg, floating down to the bottom of the ocean, right?
Yeah.
So when you cut to Michael and they're dragging him out of the water, where Spielberg puts the camera is perfectly placed so that his shoulders are obscuring his legs.
Yes.
And what I think is happening, and I think Spielberg knows this, is I think Spielberg knows that you just saw a leg being bit off and you're worried about Michael. And so he is letting you not know for a little bit longer whether or not Michael has legs. And so the way that shot happens, when it reveals the legs, there's this, and I don't know if you had that feeling, where you had the feeling is Michael okay? Does he have that? Like, I really think that's the first thing. And that is just, this is really a good argument for why we have to do this again, because I think it's almost every shot in this movie. Mm. Every shot is there for a reason. Like you mentioned, the Zolly, which is, you know, where they're zooming in and pulling back, which gives you that great effect. But also setting up that is all the wipes going back and forth in front of him as people are walking by. Yes. Another piece of amazing filmmaking. What you're talking about is the split diopter, which is where you can have something in the foreground in focus and something way in the background in focus. That is a very specific technique. There's moments, again, at that beach scene where the guy comes up to talk to him about something. I don't even know what the fuck talk to him about. Because all we're doing is trying to look past to see what's going on. And what's amazing is not only do we not hear anything that guy says?
Yeah.
But we know that Roy Scheider hasn't heard anything that that guy said. Right. You know, like, and it's so, there's so many things like this where it's just the, what Spielberg is doing in the filmmaking is doing, yeah, yeah, we're getting the story. We understand the plot and the shark, but it's actually doing all this other stuff of filling things in constantly. And yeah, as far as with the, one of the other big misconceptions is people think of this as, yeah, oh, this is about these three guys battling the shark, which it is, but that's only the last third of the movie.
Yeah.
A good half of the movie is actually, it's an economic plot. It is a classic, yes, you know, economics and industry versus safety. And right, so, and this is something we hear all the time in talking about climate change and talking about pollution and talking about, you know, hurricanes coming and all the other stuff is like, yeah, there are business interests, which are real, and we, yeah, are dependent upon our businesses to have an economy. And there are also safety interests. And I'll tell you the weird reaction I had watching this time, because I have always, of course, am Team Chief Brody. Let's, yeah, close the beaches. And there is the moment where they talk about the kid never going in the water again. And he goes, no, I don't want that. And, yeah, the fear and how much we have to watch our kids and protect our kids. And I just went, there was this beautiful time that doesn't exist anymore where, oh, we, yeah, went swimming. But, yep, where kids were out playing by themselves, where like just the opening party where it's these teenagers and they're all hanging out and they're drinking beer and smoking cigarettes and making poor choices, which is what I did as a teenager.
Cigarettes. Yeah. Yeah.
sure. And but what I mean is like those world exists far less. We have a very, very frightened younger generation and a frightened, oh, yeah, set of parents who don't let all that happen. And suddenly I was like, maybe we shouldn't have closed the beaches. Maybe a few deaths from the shark are worth actually being out in the world, which is a good thing, you know? So that's a weird reaction.
I hear you, but it's easy to close the, it's easy to not close the beaches. And like, and I think Hooper says it best, you know, you're not, to Mayor Vaughn, is you're not going to deal with this until it swims up and bites you in the ass, you know? Yeah. And he doesn't sign the thing until his kids are in the water when that shark, yep, came through. And so, you do that. And that, again, speaks to the political nature of Vaughn's character in that unless it affects him, he can create a cognitive dissonance or a distance from the problem because he thinks he's representing the business interests of the town. But you're not going to have any business interests if they keep killing people, right? And even or if the shark keeps killing people, rather. And Brody even says to him, right, you're the mayor of Shark City. It's over, bud. Whatever you think you're trying to hold on to and save, it's over, you know. And I also love the journey of, let's talk about that, the journey of Brody in the movie is fascinating too, Steve. And I know if we ever do it again, we'll get a little deeper into it, but I think it's fascinating to the way this thing is written. He's literally a fish out of water as a guy from New York, and he does talk about it, you know, his kids and his wife and all of that. So they came to Amity. There's no real, I don't think there's any real background on why they chose Amity or what was going on. Like, why did he go this? But clearly he wanted something so completely different from New York. And even tells Hooper, like, there hasn't been a shooting in 25 years in Amity or a murder or whatever. And so clearly he's done with New York. He wants a break. And here comes a shark to visit him, right? And his first instincts are correct. Why? Because he's been New York seasoned. And he knows that when this thing is happening and he gets the coroner tells him it's a shark attack, he knows what the right thing to do is, which is to stop everything, push everybody away. He's not used to factoring in the business interests in a decision like this. So we see his journey, and then he's afraid of the water and how he has to confront that, both going out on with Hooper the first time, and then later when they go out on the Orca, the whole time he's on that ship, you know? So it's a fascinating journey that we go on with him as he comes to terms with the fact that he's accepted this life. Because at the beginning of the film, he's kind of mocking it, scoffing it, and not sure if he's going to stay in Amity, it seems like. But by the end, he's very clearly now, maybe not an islander, but certainly someone who appreciates the city more and appreciates the job more. And that's the journey he goes on with his character throughout the film.
I totally agree. And I think all three of these main characters are incredibly well drawn. And spoiler alert, not only do I teach a lot of this stuff from Jaws when I was teaching, but I also, yeah, this is very big. There's a very big Jaws section in my book. So this is stuff I've thought about a lot. And in particular, yeah, with the working on these characters, Quint, Brody, and Hooper are so perfectly drawn because, yeah, of all their contrasts. So you have Brody, who is an outsider.
Yes.
Hates boats. Knows nothing about sharks,
Right.
And is motivated by guilt and a sense of responsibility to the island. You know, you have Hooper and Brody's probably middle class. You have Hooper, who's upper class, not an islander, knows a ton about boats, knows a ton about sharks, but knows things differently than what Quint knows. And his motivation is, yes, he has some duty, but scientific curiosity. He loves sharks.
Yes.
And you have Quint, lower class, local, knows a ton about boats and a ton about sharks, but differently from the way that Hooper does. And his motivation is revenge and fear. And so the way those characters are drawn, and you could see it in the incredible You Got City Hands, Mr. Hooper scene, is that you see all of the built-in conflicts and distrust differences. Because also Brody is introverted and doesn't like new experiences and is kind of conservative. Hooper is extroverted and likes new experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, like all the power dynamics between the three of them, they are incredibly rich and interesting characters, which is, again, what elevates this movie way beyond a monster movie.
It's a great point, because that scene you're talking about is the scene of the movie for the three of them to understand how they operate, right? Like you said, it's Quint questioning. Hooper's the one asking him, I want to go on the ship. And Quint is the one who is questioning whether he should get on the ship. You know, he has him try a sheep shank and then grabs his hands. And we do know, if you study Jaws, that there was legendarily issues between Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss, which may have been created by Robert Shaw or by Spielberg or by Dreyfuss in order to get in the movie. You don't know. Or maybe they legitimately just did not like each other the way they worked as actors. And so they kind of slammed heads, you know, because Robert Shaw is an old school actor. He's an old school masculine actor. It's different. Dreyfuss is more of the cerebral, like Dustin Hoffman. It's a different place. So there's a lot of reality in the back and forth that they're having. But it's Brody who comes in between them when it's getting too heated and goes, you're not going to pull this shit on the boat, are you? And Quint's like, oh, I don't know. And he goes, no, it's my charter. And he's, yeah, but it's my vessel, my charter, my ship, my thing. And so you see that the battle of wills is going on here in that scene, and you understand where everybody stands on that scene, because Hooper doesn't give. Hooper is strong. He believes in what he believes he belongs on that ship, and he's going to fight to get on that ship. Quint pushes against him, maybe in some messed up way, to test how strong he really is before he lets him come on the ship. So I like that there's all this dynamic going on, as you mentioned earlier, between the three of them, to give you a good concrete idea of their separate characters and what they're going to be like together on the boat before we get on that boat, you know?
Well, I think part of it is that for Quint, there's status is huge.
Yes.
He has to be the alpha. It is really important. Hooper doesn't exactly have to be the alpha, but he needs some status. He wants some respect and deserves some respect because he actually knows what he's doing. And what's so interesting about that dynamic is I think that Quint feels very threatened by Hooper, which is why he needs to tear him down. But I don't think he feels threatened by Brody, which is why he treats him more respectfully.
Yes.
Because he treats them more like a child. You know what I mean? He treats him like, he gives him a little pat on the head.
He's like a younger brother, basically. Yeah.
And so what's so interesting, and the thing too, is that Brody doesn't care about status.
Brody
wants to get the shark. Brody's like, you could do whatever. He's just, and so he actually, in that scene, to some degree, sacrifices his friend. He doesn't stand up for Hooper.
No.
You know, when Quint says, take him for ballast, which is incredibly insulting.
Yeah.
Brody just says, you got him. Because Brody is going, I need to get this shark and I need these two guys to do it.
Yeah.
And therefore, it doesn't matter what you yell at. He doesn't care about any of those things. Yeah. You know, and I also think it's revealed in the scene, in the great scar scene that has been, you know, reproduced everywhere. When Brody pulls up his shirt, he has a scar there. But he does not share it, you know, because he's introverted. He doesn't need to compete. He's a very, very different vibe than everybody else.
Yeah, which I think is fun to watch with his dynamic. But because when he gets emotional, those are poignant moments in the movie, right? When he gets into the mayor's face, he yells at, you know, other people, yells him get out of the boat, yells at his deputy to get the sign, you know, he's got his moments, but when he's really dialed into something and standing up to someone, then you see him, you know, oh, that's just great. That's great. You see him lose it on the boat when Quint destroys the radio, right? But why does Quint destroy the radio? It's because it's threatening him and his pursuit of his bloodthirst and, as you said, his fear that those sharks have done to him. So if he can kill this one shark, it seems like maybe he'll put to rest some of that shit from the Indianapolis, which I think is amazing to think about when you look at it.
No, absolutely. Yeah. It's so good. And can we, I'm sure you were going to get there, but I'm maybe jumping the gun on this.
We're just having fun. Let's go. What do you want to talk about?
John Williams is the greatest composer in the history of film, in my opinion.
Okay.
And this score is another goddamn masterclass. It is. Well,
think about where he's at his career, Steve. You're so right. This is Johnny Williams right now at this stage in his career. People go like, well, John Williams helped Spielberg. Yes, but it wasn't like John Williams was like this great status at the time. He was still building his name. So you're right to point out the score, Steve.
Have you watched the John Williams documentary yet?
Yeah, it's a beautiful documentary.
Oh my God. I it's so funny because if you'd asked me before who is the greatest composer in the history of film, I would have said John Williams. Hmm. But there was something so overwhelming. I highly recommend this documentary. When you see just one after another, score after score after score, and the varied nature of it and the themes that have moved into our consciousness and how many of them are just, in addition to being great movie scores, just great, great music. And this one, you know, and it's so funny. I mean, there's reasons that Jaws holds such a high place in my heart is that one of the best papers I wrote in film school was on John Williams' score. And so I went into every single leitmotif and looking at how he uses it, because what happens is he'll introduce these leitmotifs like bum da 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 da, or you have bum bum ba da bum 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 ba da dum bum bum bum, and then he replays them in different keys with different instrumentations that, and they each represent different stuff. So like when you get to the final climax and you've been introduced to all these themes, one that's like the battle, what I call the battle theme, when the humans are all working together, one where it's the sharks theme, but then there's the shark hunting theme when he's really on the attack. There's a theme for the sea. There's a theme for all these, for the happy adventure we're on.
Yeah.
And he plays literally cut by cut. Each cut you hear, oh, it's the humans. Now it's the shark. Right. Now it's this. It's going back and forth. You can close your eyes and visualize that final sequence because Williams is telling the story so perfectly through music. Yeah. It is astounding to me what he does with the score.
He adapted to blockbuster filmmaking, which I think is amazing. Now, you know, I want to make it clear, like he had obviously composed a number of scores for some pretty memorable films like The Killers, None But the Brave. You had, where is it? Land of the Giants. You had Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Jane Eyre, Fiddler on the Roof, The Poseidon Adventure, one of my personal favorites, The Long Goodbye, The Paper Chase, Spielberg's Sugarland Express, The Towering Inferno, and The Iger Sanction. Those were all done. And then Jaws came along, right? And then Star Wars. That's where John Williams went to the next level. He was able to create scores that matched the grandiosity, for lack of a better term, of these big blockbuster films, which of course weren't really seen as or known as blockbuster films at the time. Now in retrospect, clearly they are. So I think that helped as well, that John Williams understood the assignment very, very well and was able to find a way to retain the artistry of his approach to these scores while also appealing to the mainstream public and having them humming his scores for decades afterwards up until today, you know, from the 1970s on, which is pretty amazing.
No, it is. It really is astounding. What he is able to do. He is one of those people. And what's so crazy about him too, from everything I've ever seen, he seems so nice.
Yes.
He just seems like a lovely, lovely. Everyone wants to hang out with Johnny. Like, oh, let's go see Johnny. I mean, it just sounds amazing. It was funny. I was just thinking, like, one of the elements of the transition from the old world of Hollywood until the world we have today, you know, we talked about it many times, but it used to be that the A pictures were the dramas. You know, those were the big, you know, whether it was Gone with the Wind or Bridge on the River Kwai or, you know, Cleopatra, that was where the studios would put their big money. And while those movies might have adventurous elements to them, the adventures, the thrilling popcorn movies were B movies. They didn't spend the big money on them. And then what happens with Jaws, and it's like, and this is why it's so interesting of like the meld of 70s filmmaking into the big blockbuster. Because when you're meeting Chief Brody and you're in that world, it is very much a 70s film. It's character driven. It's, you know, it's nuanced. It's very human. It feels really real. But then because of the John Williams score and those incredible themes and the incredible adventure you go to the end, it becomes this thrilling thing that's the blockbuster movie. And again, it's another reason why this is the transition, is this is taking all of this old Hollywood stuff and making this thing. And it's, you know, it's also, I think this is the first movie that was really advertised on TV. It's the first movie that had a wide release. You know, it used to be that they would open a movie in New York and Los Angeles and Chicago, and they would see how it would do, and they would decide how many pictures, how many theaters to put it into. If it was doing well, they'd give it a wider release. If not, nope, let it go away. Jaws, they released in like all theaters across the country after a big TV campaign. And so suddenly that's the way that movies get released, you know?
Yeah. So again, it's just a film that has so many, I don't know, it just launched so many things that we still can deal with or confront in our pop culture all the time. And some people don't really get it, how these films have really, like, I used to see critics say they don't watch any black and white movies, some of these young critics, which drives me insane. Now I see some critics saying they don't watch anything before the 1990s, which I'm just like, what are you talking about? Like, what are you talking about? Like, do your research, study this stuff. And it's a frustrating thing because you'll understand how many of these movies from the 1970s are still echoing today. And those movies in the 1970s were influenced by the movies in the 1950s and the 40s and the 30s, you know? And so these things that you see nowadays, it's just fascinating how much, I don't know how much, I don't know what the word is, but how much of people don't ignorance. And I don't mean that in a way of like, you're a moron. I mean, ignorance in terms of not knowing how much they don't know. The films that they love so much from the last four or five decades, or three or four decades, how much they were influenced by the films that came out 5 decades or 6, 7, 8 decades ago. And it's just amazing to see that. And you can see Spielberg being influenced by so many directors who came before him all throughout Jaws, you know, including Hitchcock, as I mentioned, but also a few other directors in the way he, even the, some of the banter between the guys is very Billy Wilder-esque in their interactions. And I think that's what's amazing about the film as well. It's very influenced by the classics, by the great filmmakers of the past that we know Spielberg had studied and wanted to be like when he became a director. You know,
I mean, you know, I've always said it many times. I believe that Spielberg is the greatest storyteller of all directors. Mm. He is the clearest, most, and that comes from studying Hitchcock and Ford and Billy Wilder and all and Kurosawa and those guys. Like, that's how he figured out how to do it. I just had a thought. It's not even half baked. This is like a quarter baked thought. But I want to share it with you I was thinking about what you were saying about people not wanting to go back to the past and watch the older movies and things like that. And I think that the way it might be, again, quarter baked thought, but it might be that the way that humans are existing today is detaching them from continuity with the past, is that because we're seeing, you know, most of our interaction is through these screens, which are providing us with social media in 2-minute clips or 1-minute clip. We're seeing like these isolated snippets of things. And I hear this in the way my son talks about things, is that his way of seeing the world exists in an entirely unstable present. It's like there's just a now, and the now is changing all the time. And the information about what the reality is shifting and changing all the time. And there isn't a sense of existing within a continuity, within a history. You know what I mean? Like, I think because you and I grew up watching old TV shows and watching old movies and listening to the Beatles and listening to these other things, is we had a sense, and we knew that the Beatles love Little Richard and that they love Buddy Holly. And we, you know what I mean? Like, is that, and that creates a continuity. That creates a sense of I exist in this place in time that is connected to these other places in time. And so if I love Jackie Chan and I knew Jackie Chan loved Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, well, then it makes sense for me to look at Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin. I can understand that. And then that might lead me to look into Commedia dell'arte or old British, you know, music hall comedy or things like that. And I get a sense of a world that exists within a grand continuity and a history instead of just the, you know, the eternal now, which is where I think a lot of our society is. And I think this doesn't just apply to movies. I think this applies to history and politics and reality and economics and all this other stuff, where we're stumbling around without a sense of how the world works. So, and again, it's a quarter-baked thought, but I wanted to share it.
No, I think it's an interesting thing to consider. My initial reaction is that every generation has this feeling that everything is falling apart. I don't know that there's ever been a decade or a 10-year period, it's a decade, where people are like, oh, everything's cool. Everything's really, I'm a young person.
Absolutely, of course.
And it's right. Like I was watching the documentary on the Gilded Age the other day on PBS, and I was like, I can't even imagine being a young person when all this madness is happening with the Industrial Revolution and all these businesses are popping up and you're having to work these long hours and all this kind of stuff. And then I was watching the Theodore Roosevelt documentary that's from History Channel that's on Prime Video. And I just, this is, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right in a way, because people are made to feel nowadays that everything in front of them is the only thing that's available, right? Everything is the only thing that's there.
But and it's reality. That's reality.
Right. But there's so much more out there. And in generations past, I think we kind of sensed that there was more out there and saw after it. That's what created expansion. That's what created, not the positive and negative, going out west, creating states out there, battling things that they battled to create this stuff. There was that sense of exploration and expansion. I don't know necessarily that it's here now outside of the world of tech. Tech is where it's really at, the idea of AI and how quickly we can create it, and all these kinds of things. But AI is being created so that people want to have even easier lives and stay even more connected to just what's the now, as opposed to what is possible. And I think that's where we get kind of lost, in that, because the 70s are turbulent. The 80s, we constantly had the threat of nuclear war as teenagers. We ran drills to jump under the desk. I remember those nuclear war drills that we used to run. So there was always that sense of possibility of anything could happen at any moment. So I think it's always been that way through decades. But I hear you, what you're saying, though, that it feels much more than ever that people are just focused or trained to focus on the now.
Yeah, I think too, there's a humanity in Jaws. I mean, just right from the way that Lorraine Gray and Brody wake up in the morning, and I always go like, I kind of think they're maybe a little bit hungover the way that they're waking up, but
I'm sure they've had some wine.
But it's a very human, just like, oh, the sun is blasting in, and someone's got to feed the dogs, and just trying to get your. It's just human. And this is a skill that Spielberg had. You see it in E.T. You see it in Close Encounters so brilliantly. It's just the like, I don't think anyone pointed a camera at ordinary American kind of suburban life in the way that Steven Spielberg did in his first four or five films, is like that there's, and because it's grounded, it's like the part of what makes the movie so scary.
Yeah,
is like it's broad daylight on the beach, and it feels very familiar and just normal and ordinary. The choice to not elevate or make it more intense and just go like, look, it's a day at the beach,
right,
is what makes it absolutely terrifying. It's the humanity of the movie that is part of what makes it so great.
None of the shark attacks that we see occur at night. All of them occur in the day. I mean, there's that one at
dusk. You see Chrissy,
at the beginning. Right. Good point.
Well, that's dawn. It is the sun is technically risen.
Yeah,
so it's dawn.
It's dawn, right? And with the guys, it's just becoming dusk when they put their meat or whatever.
And they're morons. They're morons. So who cares about them anyway?
But everyone else, it's in the daytime, And so that I think that's an excellent point you bring up, Steve. That I'd never thought about that. That adds to the terror and ferocity as you're seeing this thing in the brightest light possible. So you can really grasp how unsettling this thing actually is, and explore it as you're watching the movie. Are there any things, you're famous on our show for being like, well, I wouldn't have shot it that way, or I wouldn't have done this that way. Are there any things when you watch the movie? I don't know. It's in your top 10, as you said. And I called it almost a near perfect movie. Is there anything for you that when you look at this film, you're like, oh, I wish they'd done this, I wish they'd done that. Cause there's stuff in the book that isn't in the movie, like Hooper and his wife,
whatever her name is. Wife.
Yeah, they have the affair. Elaine Gray, they have an affair that's not in the movie. Hooper dies in the book, but he stays alive in the movie. So is there anything, which of course is Spielberg touch, but is there anything that like in the movie yourself that maybe gives you pause now watching it all these years later?
Honestly, dude, if this is not a perfect movie, it's as damn close as I can imagine. No, I don't have a single shot. Not only that, but I actually think that those changes show the genius of Spielberg. And and what's funny, because I know when we did Jurassic Park, there's real connections between Jurassic Park and Jaws.
You have an
opening scary scene. You have the tension between the economic realities of we want to open the park versus the safety realities. And there's a joy in both Jurassic Park and Jaws. Yeah. Like it's a really interesting thing is that you have those moments where the barrels, you know, you're in the barrel chase and you have that thrilling adventurous music. Oh, yeah. It is so joyful. And that's the same joy you feel when you first see the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. So like the reason I say all this is that I think there is not only is there nothing I would change about this movie, but to me, there is a thing. I'm sure you've had this where you just, cause I fancy myself a director. I introduced myself as a director at the beginning. I have directed films. Yes. I have directed things.
You and get this to is call where, yourself a director. Yes.
Sure. And this is where I go, okay, I wasn't even playing AAA ball. I was like on some farm team somewhere playing, looking up at someone in the bigs.
Gotcha.
Cause I look at Jaws and Spielberg. And when I was young, I was like, I'm totally going to be Steven Spielberg. I'm going to be Steven Spielberg and Orson Welles and all rolled into one and I'll be the greatest director. And now I look at Steven Spielberg knowing a shit ton more about making movies than I knew 30 years ago. And I go, holy fuck, I could never do that. He is so far beyond. I know how hard this job is. Looking at what he does, shot to shot, moment to moment, performance, working with actors, working with score, the whole thing, I just go, wow. That's really where I am. And you know what? This goes back to like the origins of the cinephiles. It's the experience of wow, which is why I want to do the show with you. And why, although we've done a few movies that are not necessarily great movies and some that we, you know, and some of our watch alongs and things like that, where we tore some stuff apart. And I'm certainly capable of doing that. That's not why I want to show up and talk about movies on the show with you. Yeah. I want to show up and go, I'm in awe. And in this movie, there is no question that I am in awe.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the humanity thing is a great thing you bring up, Steve, because watching it this time as well, as an older person now, as someone who's been in a long-term relationship longer than I've ever been with anybody in my life, watching those moments just resonate differently. I don't have kids, obviously, so the Michael stuff and his son doesn't quite viscerally resonate with me in the way that I know it might for other parents like you and other parents who watch the movie. But certainly you can feel that sense. And even she's dealing with his moods. As you said, he's an introvert. He's got some moodiness to him when he's at the table and when Hooper shows up with the wine, he's like, I like to talk to your husband. She's like, so would I, you see that there's a little tension there between them because he does get into these places and she sees the bigger picture. He gets caught up in what is affecting him in the moment. And you can tell that she has a wider vision than he does. And sometimes you need that in a relationship, that the other person sees it a little differently than you do. So it gets you to kind of come out of your shell or come out of that place that you're in. So you can maybe share a little bit of that vision and find that like leveling out, so to speak, so you can move forward. And you see that throughout the movie, and I like their little banter about when Michael's in the boat, she's like, come on, you don't make him scared of the water. And then she sees that picture and yells at him. So there's things that go back and forth. But when he gets on the boat, the fact that she turns and runs through Quint's place out of fear, like she doesn't want him to see her cry. So she runs away from the situation so she can be alone to cry and miss him because she doesn't want him to be afraid or take that with him. That's how much she loves him. And those little mini sacrifices that you do in relationships adds to the humanity that you see in the movie as you're talking about, which I think is beautiful to see in the film.
It's a hero going off to war moment. Yeah. I mean, that's what it is. Yeah. But what's so great about it is that you have the most unassuming hero possible with Brody, who's just, just tell him I'm going fishing. Like that stuff, thinking about what the kids are believing, knowing that she's upset. But then you also have, while this is going on, you're looking at the just complete shit show chaos of crazy Quint and Hooper with his tanks of oxygen and his equipment. And just she's seeing you're going on that boat.
Yes.
With those people.
With that guy.
yeah. with that guy. Yeah. I mean, that's what's so great about the scene is it's all of, and again, it's all of the stuff you've earned with those characters that creates that moment where she has to run away, you know?
Yeah. I mean, him, Quint just going into all of his melodies and all of his weird banter back and forth as they're leaving Doc, all of that is madness, but it's his joy of being in control of a boat again, being out on a charter. He's almost like a child when he's leading driving the ship out of the dock there because he's so excited about what they're going on. But yeah, what's it be like for a person who's not that kind of whacked out to watch this guy indulge in all of his excitement of the madness that they're about to enter by going back to his shanties and his melodies and his jokes, you know, all these kinds of things. Not so bad with this vicinity. Those kinds of things. You're seeing that with him and how that must unsettle her and stuff. But I also think the humanity of the town. This is another thing that's essential about the movie. You know, people, Steve, on my other shows, they come after me because I get upset when I don't, I get upset. I ding films or TV shows that don't take the time to flesh out the community they're presenting and to flesh out the ensemble characters. And that doesn't mean spending hours with them. It just means fleshing it out in a way that makes sense, that you can connect to and gravitate to. And we spend enough time in the town in this movie. That's another thing that's great about the construction of the film. We really get to understand Amity Island and the people who inhabit Amity Island, both the beachgoers and the politicians and the business owners. And you're seeing that through, and the police, obviously, you're seeing that throughout. And I think that's a fascinating thing. And he gives us a good taste of what this life is like. I mean, I was almost thinking of Parks and Rec while I was watching the movie this time around and how similar to that some of these scenes are that happen within the community and within the town. And I think it's so smart that Spielberg spent time and the screenwriter and Carl Gottlieb spent time fleshing out this town. I'm sure it's in Benchley's book. I haven't read it in forever. I can't remember, but like, it's so smart to flesh that out. So you have an idea and understanding that this could happen to you. This could be your town. You know, it's a place you might have grown up. And there's a universality in that for the audience that I think is a brilliant thing to do in the film.
One of the things about movie making is that time is a zero-sum game. So any time I spend in my film on a shopkeeper or on a mayor's assistant or the deputy sheriff is time I'm not spending on sharks in my main characters. And so, but what he does, because he takes this tapestry of this town in particular, I'll tell you the person who sells it for me more than anyone. And there's several that are great, but it's the woman we meet on the beach who's later in the meeting. And she's like, I don't think that's funny. I don't think that's funny at all. She seems, and I think it's been a long time since I researched this film, but I do know that he cast a bunch of locals and she totally seems like a local. Does is that I don't go, at the end, I'm angry at the mayor because he resisted closing the beaches and he shouldn't have. But I'm not angry at the townspeople who don't want the beaches closed because it is their business. That's the, you know, it's like you come, and because they come off as totally real and totally sincere, they don't know. I mean, you know, you've heard, I mean, we just went through a pandemic where when it started, people are like, well, how big a deal is this really going to be? And then we have arguments about how big a deal it was and whether or not it was worth doing what we did. And I think these are excellent discussions to have about how did we do it last time and should we do it better next time? I don't think the way we're having those discussions is healthy or constructive at this moment. But like those townspeople are just like, they're real people. They spend their whole winter gearing up for the summer season where they're going to make all their money. And now they're looking at a real tough situation. I think they do a great job setting all that up.
That's a great point, Steve. One of the gifts of the movie is that he doesn't default by painting them to be these dumb yokels in the town. Yes, there are like a couple of people like, it's a what? When he says tiger shark, but we don't know if that guy's even from the town because that's when all these people have come all swarming in to try it. So we don't even know if he's an islander or whatever, but there are moments, but even Quint says it when he's first introduced that, If we don't catch the shark, if you don't hire me to catch the shark, you guys are going to be on welfare for the winter. It's your choice. So he knows the stakes and he knows how tenuous the town's existence or how tied the town's existence is to the summer season and how tenuous their existence as a town is. If one summer goes by and they lose money in that summer. So again, there's an authenticity to that. There's real stakes to that we feel and we can connect to why Brody is feeling the pressure from the mayor and the city council and other people and the business owners, because yes, it's horrible this happened, but also I need to be able to live. I need to be able to pay my rent. I need to be able to feed my kids. And when you're 10 years old watching this movie, or 50, even 15, or maybe even slightly older, you're like, well, they're idiots. They could die. But when you get older, you go, you know what? I kind of get, as you were saying earlier, I'm not saying I support it, but I'm saying I kind of get it. They're not as villainous as I thought when I was a kid, you know?
I mean, as you know, a hard-hearted person in some way, like some people are going to die in any way we do things. You set the speed limit for the freeway and you go like, well, we could send it at 55. We could set it at 75. Well, guess what? If you set it at 75, we'll all get places a lot faster, but a few more people are going to die. That's what's these are decisions we make all over the place. And I just had to say it again. One of the ideas in this movie, which is territoriality, which is the idea that once the shark finds some delicious tidbits, they're going to hang around and keep eating them forever. That is totally bullshit. And this is the thing about this movie is, I mean,
he did say it was a theory. He did say
that. Sharks have a hunting ground. That's certainly true. They'll travel from, you know, from Hawaii to the Great White Cafe where they hang out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And then they'll end up at Guadalupe and San Francisco, and they feed off elephant seals and tuna and Dorado and all that stuff. Totally true. But the idea that a shark like takes a bite of a human and then goes, ooh, this is delicious, I'm going to hang out at these beaches, has never fucking happened ever. It's, you know, it's like, I mean, in this movie, so there's Chrissy at the beginning, then the kid, then the guy that gets his leg bit off, then Gardner, whatever his name is, whose head we see, and then Quint. So that's, it's five people that get killed by the shark in this movie. Is that correct? Or is there another that I'm skipping?
It says six here on the USA Today.
So maybe it's six.
They include the dog. It's because it's kind of intimated that the dog is killed, right?
So the average number of people killed by sharks on the entire planet Earth a year is something like 12 people. Maybe 17 on a good year. Maybe seven on a small year. Necessarily. Good year for the sharks. So like the idea that one shark hangs out. And by the way, and this is going to either scare you or make you feel better. If you go swim in an ocean beach and you go into the water, there's a shark near you. I am guaranteeing you there's a shark there who's not interested in you at all. They don't bite us at all. It almost never happens. The number one animal to kill you is the mosquito. It kills about 2 million people a year. After that, we got bees and we've got snakes and we got dogs and we got hippos. Sharks aren't anywhere. They're not even close of a threat to us in any way. Do not be. You shouldn't. I know we're all scared of sharks. The movie scared the crap out of us. But in terms of the threat, your stairs, your bathtub, your car, everything is a bigger threat to you than sharks.
So I'm looking at the Florida Museum analytics here, and it said the 2024 worldwide total, there have been 47 confirmed unprovoked cases, which is in line with the most recent five-year average of 64 incidents annually. There were only 7 confirmed shark-related fatalities last year in 2023, so 2 years ago, 4 of which are assigned as unprovoked. This number is in line with five-year annual global averages of 6 unprovoked fatalities per year. So you're right. It is less than double
really digits. Small.
It's really small.
Well, and this is the thing, is that sharks don't eat people in general. Is that what happens is you're on a surfboard, so you have that oblong shape, your little feet are paddling, a shark, they're apex hunters who are opportunity killers, they're underneath, they're looking up, the sun is coming down through the water, so all they see is this oblong silhouette with these little things to look like flippers. And from down at the bottom, there, that could be an elephant seal. And they come going straight up. They hit that person on the surfboard, take a bite and go, that's not an elephant seal. And they swim away because, they don't eat it. I mean, that person might die or lose, you know, it's really bad. But the idea like the shark is hunting humans is totally not true. Not true at all.
Making it very clear.
I spent many years of my life working on these movies, so I have strong opinions about them.
Very true. I'm going to throw some trivia out there, and then we got to wrap up here, Steve. I think just to let you all know about the movie. It was nominated for 4 Oscars, 1-3. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, if we ever do the show again, or maybe we did when we talked about the show here. As you said, there are 6 victims. Peter Benchley, the writer of the original novels in the movie, is a TV reporter. It was mostly filmed on Martha's Vineyard. Yeah, go ahead. What?
Yeah, I was nodding along.
Oh, okay, I thought you said no. But I was like, oh, did I get something wrong? Murray Hamilton was chosen to play Mayor Vaughn because he resembled Richard Nixon, which I think is hilarious. The film was declared culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant by the National Film Registry back in 2001. Charlton Heston lobbied hard for the Brody role, which I think is amazing. And one thing I did not know is that the book is based on, although Benchley claims it isn't, a lot of people think Benchley's lying. The book is supposedly based on an actual 1916 incident at the Jersey Shore where a rogue shark killed four bathers, two of them in an estuary, where there's a similar scene in the movie. And I didn't know this, but apparently during the beach scene, you can hear some Scott Joplin ragtime music, which was maybe Spielberg's wink at Robert Shaw, who had been in The Sting in 1973, which I think is hilarious. Apparently, Gregory Peck refused to let a scene of Moby Dick be shown in the movie. Quint was going to be watching a scene of Moby Dick on the TV, and he said no, because he didn't want it to be connected with this kind of movie, is what he'd said. So that's a little bit of that trivia there as well. Of course, Jaws lost the Best Picture Oscar to One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest. No one's going to argue that, I don't think, Steve. So that's an interesting situation. It was called Flaws instead of Jaws because of the amount of time it took to shoot the movie. And one last thing. Oh, Jeff Bridges, John Voight, and Timothy Bottoms were all considered for Hooper. So nice, interesting things. And I do want to read a couple of quotes from horror directors about the movie. Soderbergh says it's directors, I should say, not just horror directors. Steven Soderbergh says it's a great story of what Steven Spielberg accomplished by surviving what was a nightmare. If that person hadn't made it, it probably wouldn't have been made at all. It certainly wouldn't be a classic. Jason Blum of Blumhouse said, when directors bring us ideas, Jaws is still referenced as much as any other movie. Even young filmmakers say it's going to be like the shark in Jaws. That's incredible for a film that's 50 years old. And David Brown, one of the film's producers, said, everywhere we went, people treated us with sympathy, like we had some kind of illness when we were making the movie. And they said, I hope you overcome your difficulties. And Eli Roth, who I'm not a big fan of as a director, but certainly he is a director, said, this movie changed cinema, and you still can't go to a summer blockbuster or to the beach without thinking about it. So much of the language of cinema comes from this film. Spielberg created all of it. Now, I may not 100% agree with Eli Roth saying Spielberg created all of it, but certainly for modern filmmakers, you could argue Spielberg was their entryway into these techniques that he had probably got from a number of the classic filmmakers in the past.
You know what just occurred to me is there's so much time where we've gotten to listen to a filmmaker like Martin Scorsese talk about film and say, this is whether you watch his journeys through Italy or through classic cinema or here, because he is an encyclopedic person with encyclopedic knowledge about film and can explain why everything is important. Yeah. My guess is that Steven Spielberg is exactly the same way, but he hasn't done that with us as much. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I've certainly heard him talk about John Ford and David Lean and some of the other filmmakers he admires, but we haven't had him on the Cinephiles. I mean, it's like having Steven Spielberg on the Cinephiles to talk about a John Ford film or to talk about a Hitchcock film. Like, because he fucking gets it, man. Yeah, I mean, I keep saying, I know my admiration for him knows no bounds, but like his understanding of this art form is beyond compare as far as
agreed. Well, we should hit some of these questions, Steve. People sent in some kind Streamlabs super chats as we're heading towards wrapping up the show in this tribute to Jaws. Carlton Runner, what's up, Carlton? He says, London calling. I saw Jaws for the first time 5 years ago. Lifelong fear of sharks that your amazing documentary, Steve, helped me conquer. Ah, there you go.
Carlton, that is awesome. That was the intention when we made that doc was to really be the anti-Shark Week doc. And I've heard that several times. There's nothing that could make me happier to hear that people who are scared of sharks feel a little bit better after seeing our documentary. That's huge. Thank you.
Right on. Vincent Zawada said, happy 50th to Jaws. Perfect film. More Kurosawa and Hitchcock in the near future. Love you guys. We definitely need to do more Hitchcock and more Kurosawa down the road, Steve, for sure.
All right. And there's Ikiru, there's Rashomon, there's Ron.
Ron.
Ron
is the one. Yeah. Yeah.
And there, and man, there's a bunch of Hitchcock. I'm trying to think of what would be the next Hitchcock I'd want to do. Some good ones.
It would be interesting to see which one we choose to do next, for sure.
Yeah.
Vincent Zawada also says, love that Spielberg had nightmares for months afterwards. I'm sure I would too. Probably not just shark related.
I've heard him talk about it. He would dream that he was still on the island because he didn't leave the island for like 9 months. And then he would dream that he was still in that hotel room or whatever.
Well, apparently he didn't show up on set for the last day of film shoot because he thought that the crew might try to drown him or kill him. And since the film became a success, that became his tradition to not show up on the last day of filming.
Oh, so, that's fascinating.
Funny stuff from Spielberg. Fantastic 314 says, here's my $2 to do a Beastmaster Cinephiles. LOL.
I haven't seen that movie in at least probably 40 years. I've watched it many times.
Is that Mark Singer as Beastmaster? Is that correct? Yeah, I think so. You're going to need more than $2, buddy. Sterling Jones, I love this movie. Read the book recently. Glad Spielberg took out the affair with Hooper and Ellen Brody. Yeah, I have to agree with that, Steve. I like that it's not there in the film. I think it would have added one extra complicated element to the movie, and the movie was already rife with complications and challenges and obstacles within the story.
One of the Spielberg's great skills is to see what is unnecessary. And I think that the two big choices with Jaws are, one, removing the affair, and two, in the book, they go out onto the boat in the day and they come back every night, and then they go out the next day and they come back. Having them go out and not come back is huge. This story is exactly as important as switching who liked kids in Jurassic Park. In the book, the Sam Neill character likes kids, and in the movie, he does not like kids. And that is a classic, simple Spielberg choice to make it way, way better.
I also think having Hooper live is actually a smart choice by Spielberg as well, you know, because you really do like Hooper's character. And you had seen enough deaths. You didn't need to see his to have some kind of emotional impact about what's going on. So Wada also says, love that Gorilla Minus One is the Jaws. Oh, you mean Godzilla Minus One is the Jaws of today? I can see that. I just got that in 4K. It's so good. Fantastic 314 says, the Martin and Sean mimic scene was so beautiful and the music was perfect. Yeah, Steve, the scene with him and his son there at the table as well is really sweet, right?
Well, and I know that what happened was that it was between shots and, Roy Scheider was just playing around with the kids, trying to keep them entertained. He was doing this little making faces thing, and Spielberg saw it and went, that needs to be in the movie. And I think it's a critical scene because it is so emotionally resonant and powerful and makes you feel all of the pain that Roy Scheider is going through without any dialogue at all. It's amazing.
When he asks for the kiss from his son because he needs it, that is an amazing moment, man. I mean, that moment has never hit me like it hit me watching it this time around. And it's just sweet because, you know what? We got tough days in life. Yeah. And sometimes you need someone who cares about you to just kind of give you a little bit of love so you can get through those tough moments. And I love that there. Alan Smithy says, well, what about Jaws the Revenge, where that time it was personal? That shark swam all the way from the northeastern coast of America to the Bahamas just to try to eat Lauren Gray for helping kill his mom. That's where we went too far, right? I blame the sequels. I don't know if I blame Jaws. I blame the sequels, but go ahead. Yes.
Two things about it. Well, first of all, this obviously disproves everything I've said about sharks. They are just as vengeful and horrible as presented. I mean, the movie is proof. The second thing, I think there's the thing, which I know I've talked about many times in Understanding Comics, where he talks about that someone comes up with a new style of making a movie that's built on all of this complex craft and thought and work. And it presents this surface, and then people go, oh, that's good. Let's just redo the surface. And so they go, people love to see a movie about a killer shark hunting people. Let's do another killer shark hunting people. And they don't get all of the stuff that we've been talking about this whole thing, the character development, the reality of the world, the complexity of the situations, the complicated motivations, all the incredible camera work, the amazing storytelling. You take all that stuff out, and then you just got a monster movie, you know?
That's true. That's very true. Vincent Zawada also says Notorious for next Hitchcock.
Might be my favorite Hitchcock movie. Ooh. Might be. Okay. I haven't seen it in a long time, but when I went on a Hitchcock binge about 15 years ago, got to Notorious and went, ooh, this one's really good.
I don't know if I've ever seen it, so that could be fun to do on the show. All right, we got three Streamlabs. Let me read them real quick, Steve. Let's get some answers to these. Fredtastic says again, says, "Hey, John and Steve, this was the first horror movie that I've seen in the theater. I was too young and was scared out of my mind, not just from what I saw on the screen, but the screaming of the audience. It affected me for months." Yeah, as you mentioned, your son experiencing a comedy where everyone's laughing.
Right.
Imagine what it would be like to be sitting there in the theater and seeing people's reactions to everything that was happening there on the screen. So, yeah, do you consider it to be a horror film? Some people have pushed back on it being considered a horror film, and I don't know what they're talking about. I think it defies
categorization for me. Oh, is that when great. It is a horror film, it is as scary. I still think the open. I struggle. When I just watched it, I'm stressed out in the opening scene of Jaws. I think there are three or four unbelievably scary scenes, but yeah. I also think it's an adventure film. That third,
yes.
It's not. It's mostly not horror. I would say once we're on the boat, it's more adventure. But there's some very scary moments. I also think it's a character study. And I think this defies categorization for me.
I think that's an excellent answer. I would have to agree with Steve. I think it falls into so many categories that it can't be categorized as specifically anything other than a great film.
Yeah.
Evermore Ministries. Thank you, Evermore. Says, "Hey, John and Steve, such a special film and so glad for this discussion. I have seen, logged, and ranked over 3,000 films on Letterboxd. I have only ranked 24 as 5 stars. Jaws is one of those rare 5-star films. The shark is working. Thanks, guys."
Yeah.
Ed and Kim Buskirk. Oh, great to see Ed and Kim. Thank you, Ed. 5 stars, I think, would be valid for this movie, Steve.
I agree with your ranking system, Ed. And that 3,000 movies you got on Letterboxd, that's pretty cool.
That's amazing. I want to see what your other 23 are, Ed. And we'll see if I agree. Justin Toner says, "Hi, John and Steve. Jaws has been..." What's up, Justin? Good to see you, brother. "Jaws has been one of my favorite movies since I was a kid and saw it on TV. I had a plastic toy shark and used it to create my own Jaws sequels in the tub and in the lake next to our house using various action figures and boat toys." That's awesome.
Well, so apparently, Justin, you did not have the negative experience that's haunted you forever like a lot of people have had with that movie, which is great.
That is great. Yeah. I don't know if I've ever played with a shark. I think I was so traumatized. But that's awesome that you had that, Justin. That's so cool. Fantastic Back asking, "Hearing Quint's shoes squeaking before he gets eaten still creeps me out." Oh, yeah. Squeaking against the wood.
Yeah.
Again, the sound design, right, Steve? Just brilliant to add that to the element of horror that's going on.
It's great. And while the Quint's death, when that shark leaps up on the boat, is, you know, it's definitely like, okay, there's a big, you know, I've seen some latex and the big like thing, but it still gets me. Quint's death still gets you. Me.
Yeah. Hell yeah, it gets you. Because his squeal as he lets go of Brody, or slips out of Brody's hand, and that it's the tank that causes him to lose his grip. And then the sound he makes when those teeth dig their way into his gut is just horrific. Just horrific.
And to me, it's the setup of the Herbie Robinson story. He's from Cleveland, bosun's mate. Because the story of him where he finds him bitten in half in the water, below the weight. And that's what's happening to Quint right now.
Yeah, yeah. And Quint almost predicts what's going to happen to himself earlier in the movie, because he says, "There's a big shark. He's knocked you about, tenderizes you, and down you go," which is exactly what happened to Quint. In the end, on that. Oh, that scene still gets me, man. You're right. Josh Vaskovich says, "What is there that hasn't already been said about this film? A true masterpiece, game changer, and an all-timer." Yeah, agreed.
Yes, here's something that's never been said about this film.
Okay.
Easiest charades clue ever. One syllable, point to your teeth, you're done. There, no one's ever said that.
That's true. That's true. That's a great point. Yes. Excellent. all right. Well, there you go. I think that's everything, Steve. I think that's all the Streamlabs and Super Chats. I would love to see a Criterion of Jaws. Wouldn't you love to see a Criterion of Jaws? That would be incredible. But I doubt they'd ever let go of those rights to let Criterion do it. There you go. So let us know what you think. Do you want us to redo Jaws? It's certainly something that Steve kind of brought up earlier, and I've been thinking about it separately on my own as well. So I think it's very possible that we might do this down the road, but let us know what you think in the comment section or tweet at us. And for our board members, this is absolutely going to be on the agenda for our next board meeting, which should be in the next few days. And we'll have a discussion about that possibly. So start thinking what your answers are going to be. And for anyone else who's watching, anything else you want to talk about from the movie, let us know down in the comment section below. What do you love about the film? Does anything bother you about the film? Where do you rank the film? Do you agree that it's 5 stars? And what was your first experience watching Jaws? Let us know. Steve, another fun show with you. Please tell the folks what they need to know here, brother.
Well, they need to know. Let me begin with sharks were first evolved 140 million. No. So the cinephiles, you could support us if you really want to get into this discussion about whether or not we should be redoing Jaws or some of these other movies in that, you know, second year of the cinephiles. The best place to do it is on our advisory board, which you can join by going to patreon.com/thecinephiles. That's at our highest tiers. But if you want to go to some of the lower tiers, just for $1 a month, you can get our schedule for every upcoming month. We have ad-free versions of the show, our Cinephile shorts. We do watch-alongs every month. We have, you know, you can suggest things for the Cinephile shorts. You can also get those ad-free versions of the show as well as the shorts through Apple Podcasts. So if you're an Apple person, it's one click. It's super easy. You can buy or stream every single movie we've ever reviewed on cinephiles.net, and you can reach me at SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
Yeah, and for those of you listening to the audio version, another way you can help support us is if you hear any products during the commercial breaks that you want to try out from our numerous sponsors, please make sure to use our code and try them out. We would encourage you to try them out. Not everyone can contribute or not everyone can be part of the Patreon, but if these products appeal to you and they work for your daily life, then maybe you can make sense to get it. And if you do, please use our code because you'll get a lot of great discounts. And as I've been pushing lately, the Awaken 180 weight loss system has been amazing. I am down 40 pounds since when I first started 4 months ago now, officially as of this morning, 2/24. And it's just been a fantastic journey and they've been amazing people. So highly recommend you all check them out. And they've got a 7-day money back guarantee. So that's another great way to get started with this, is that you can get your money back if you feel that it's not working for you in those 7 days. And trust me, it won't take long for it to kick in. So just sending that out. So thank you to everybody who joined us. We love you madly. Make sure you subscribe to the YouTube channel down below here as we're growing our subscriber base on the Cinephiles YouTube channel. We really would appreciate it. You can follow me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And if you want to check out my channel, head on over there. Just type in The Outlaw Nation for now, because it'll be changing July 1st, July 2nd. It'll be changing. But for now, it's The Outlaw Nation. Go and check it out there. And I don't know. Steve and I, we have an announcement about this movie coming up very soon that we'll let you know about. And don't forget the Jaws 50th anniversary documentary coming out from National Geographic on July 10th. Take a look at that one as well. All right, take care of yourselves. Be well. And we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode here of The Cinephiles. And peace until then.